I'm Kerry Stewart. Welcome to Encounter, abc.net.au/rn. This week we're exploring an ethical model for business that can help to create a healthy society as well as a buoyant economy. The global financial crisis revealed that some corporate leaders don't adhere to a set of ethical principles. It's not that there aren't any written down. In fact, corporate giant Enron has an admirable mission statement that has respect, integrity, communication and excellence as its core values. So today, we'll find out how and why ethics have been ignored by some corporations. Susan Long is Professor of Creative and Sustainable Organisations at RMIT.
I've become very interested in the perverse aspects of organisations. This really comes from my background as a psychotherapist, I guess, in thinking about perverse activity. And I did some research some years ago in the prison system, and the area of research that I was looking at was case management of sex offenders. But I've done a lot of work with organisations, and I thought there's something about organisations at times that's quite perverse. So rather than focus on the individual, I've tried to sort of look at an organisation as if it were a unity. Not an individual, but I guess the way the culture of the organisation works as a whole and picks up some of these perverse dynamics.
Susan Long's book is called The Perverse Organisation and Its Deadly Sins. And we'll hear more about how some organisations are entangled with the deadly sins of greed, pride, envy and sloth a bit later. On a more positive note, we'll also find out about a new movement in business and business education that's focused on the virtues of corporate social and environmental responsibility. Many people doing this work have a religious or spiritual background, which they say helps to give them an ethical direction. One of them is Dr. Moses Parva, Professor of Business Ethics and Accounting at Yeshiva University in New York.
The way I teach my course at Yeshiva University is actually based on cases that former students have written up as part of their final project. And I call these projects defining moments. Some of the students are actually former Israeli Army soldiers, and so I asked them, the students, to describe what the situation was and how they faced the situation. Did they realize at the time that there was an ethical dilemma? Did they walk right through it? And if they did realize that it was an ethical dilemma at the time, what was their thought process? Did they return to the Bible or to the Talmud? Did the students ask a rabbi, or did they consult with their colleagues, with their friends? And then in class, we have a discussion and generally try to bring in Jewish sources that fit with the situation.
My name's Laura Berry, and I'm the executive director of the Interfaith Center on Corporate Responsibility. My faith background, I was raised a Catholic, attended Catholic schools, and am still a practicing Catholic. The Interfaith Center is an organization, it's a membership organization that came together about 40 years ago to start to address the divide, if you will, between morality and markets. It was a group of people of a number of different faiths that came together to use their roles as investors to start to address corporate behaviors that our members felt were not in alignment with their faith traditions, with moral and ethical principles of good business practice, and ultimately led to poor investment performance. Businesses that pay attention to a broad range of justice and sustainability kinds of issues, whether it's how they treat their workforce or the way they approach the communities in which they operate, really goes back to the 400-year-old development of the corporate model in the first place. Corporations were originally created to allow society to do things that individuals couldn't do on their own. So, in fact, there is this kind of community background that is at the very heart of the corporate structure when the legal entity was first created.
But maximization of profit seems to be the most important function of corporations today. And some even argue that their bottom line is negatively affected by acting responsibly. Moses Parver's research has shown the opposite is the case. So why is that?
I think that there are many reasons to believe that if you focus in on your environmental performance in the long run, you're going to do better than a competitor that strictly focusing in on bottom line financial performance. I mean, profit maximization is a very short-term, very myopic way of looking at business performance. And certainly as society changes and societal expectations change, the companies that are, you know, not following but are leading are the companies that are going to be growing and expanding over time. And the irony is that by not focusing on profits exclusively, you can actually increase the profits. And I think it's kind of like happiness. I mean, if you're focused exclusively on trying to live a happy life, you may not succeed. But if you're focusing on being part of a community and contributing and being a responsible parent or, you know, whatever your profession is, doing that profession in the best of your ability, happiness is a happy side effect. And I think it's the same kind of thing with profits, that if you're focused in on these legitimate responsibilities that society now expects companies to live up to, then these companies will succeed in the long term.
I think the idea that there are costs associated with investing ethically is a naive idea. I think that when one looks at the simple construct that says, I'm going to create a portfolio and I will not invest in quote unquote bad companies. So I limit my universe because I'll just avoid the companies that do bad things. Then one might risk some kind of cost to alpha or to excess return in the portfolio. But if rather one says, as a long-term investor who must invest across all sectors, I have a responsibility as an investor to consider the ethical phenomenon of my investments and to work with the companies in which I invest to actually change the things that are wrong, I think, first of all, a couple of things happen. You get to understand the corporate management of the individual companies across sectors much better. Then you make better investment decisions and ultimately could have better investment results. And finally, I think one thing that we haven't captured and that certainly Pope Benedict XVI's recent encyclical speaks about a lot is how the recent collapse in the markets has really given us a platform to reevaluate how does capital work? What should we be thinking about? What kinds of decisions should we be making? And how do we start to monetize social capital so that companies that cause problems for the world through negative externalities like pollution or like mistreating their employees, that there should be an economic cost considered in the valuation models? And companies that actually create social good should also get credit in those models.
So what's driving change in the business world? Dr. David Bubnalytic is the editor of a recently published book called Spirituality and Corporate Social Responsibility, Interpenetrating Worlds, and a senior lecturer in the Management School at the University of Technology in Sydney.
I think we need to look at three things that are driving change in business. And it's not just in business, it's a driving change that's happening across our society. And one is, I think people are starting to really question the old notion of happiness, that economic success led to happiness. And I think people are really becoming clearer and clearer that economic success does not necessarily equal happiness. I think we're starting to realise also that there are other ways of achieving happiness and achieving what we want in life. And so there's been a collective shift to what is a good life to live? What is it good to be in the world? And I think the answers have been there for many years, but I think we've just been distracted from looking at the things that really count, and that's love, relationship, generosity, the sorts of things that we think of when we think of a good person, the sorts of virtues that we can see in all religions. The second reason, I think, in terms of a society, we're becoming suspicious of the promises of modernity. And the promises of modernity are that technology will deliver us from suffering. And I think we find that it doesn't. In fact, in many ways, technology brings with it new issues. What we thought were the wonderful technological dream of modernity, the dream of growing wealth and growing opportunities to have things, aren't the answer. In fact, what we're finding as the answer is what we do. And the growing place of work in society is meaning that people are putting more and more of their lives into the workforce. And they're starting to say, well, actually, I spend most of my time at work, and that's not much fun at all. The third big change in thinking, I think, is coming about because of the impact of human development on the planet. And I think as we start to reach, I think the population by 2050 is going to be 9 billion, and as China, with its huge population, and India start to converge on our lifestyle, we're going to be confronted by the fact that there are not enough resources for all of us, given the current way we live. Now, sustainable practices are going to be a way in which we can address some of those differences. We can do things with less. But I think ultimately we're entering an age of limits. And to have less, we need to find satisfaction in our lives in other ways. And I think that's where businesses and the business schools, I think, is starting to shift towards recognising that sustainability is an issue. I know in the University of Technology, I've just been given a very large grant to start auditing every single subject to look at how well we are engaging with the questions of sustainability.
But change is hard, particularly within corporations that have established an unhealthy culture. Dr. Susan Long, the author of The Perverse Organisation and Its Deadly Sins, has identified the characteristics of such businesses.
There are sort of five areas that I delineated when looking at perverse dynamics. And I guess they centre around the notion of narcissism or me-first culture, the kind of thing that we're all talking about nowadays where the individual ego becomes very dominant, over and above, I guess, the sort of sense of interest in the broader community. And the second point is that in perverse dynamics, there's a lot of denial. One often denies the kind of behaviours that one's involved in. And the denial is a protective force, so that very often we start to find that some of the CEOs or some of the senior people in organisations, having made mistakes, then cover up. It's not the mistakes that's perverse. Everybody makes mistakes. It's the attempt to cover up the mistake and hide it because of the fear of being found to not really have the knowledge, to not really know, to not be in charge. And the third part of the perverse dynamic is that the perverse organisation starts to find around it accomplices. So it's not just a kind of a perverse denial left by oneself that just looks like a delusion, but actually starts to bring in a whole lot of other players in the broader system. And another dynamic is that the people then in the organisation as a whole, the culture, are brought along with this kind of denial and activity, and are very often, because of the me-first culture, the way that the denial is operating, the whole culture becomes a very instrumental culture. And both people and often customers and clients start to become used as sort of instruments of the organisation rather than people in their own right with their own motives and capacities. And this whole dynamic tends to perpetuate itself.
You're with Encounter on ABC Radio National. So how can ethics informed by religious teachings and spiritual practice help people to overcome this perversion in business that Susan Long describes? Dr. Moses Pava teaches business ethics and accounting at Yeshiva University in New York, and his latest book is Jewish Ethics as Dialogue, Using Spiritual Language to Reimagine a Better World.
From a Jewish point of view, chesed, which is usually translated as loving kindness or loving kindness in the context of the covenant, is an idea that can really apply in many, many different ways in a business context, both at an individual level, the way one treats one's coworkers, and also at an organizational level, the way an organization is structured, the mission of an organization, et cetera, et cetera. Other ideas, there's a notion in Jewish law called Lifnim Mishurat HaDin, which is basically going beyond the letter of the law. It isn't sufficient to say, you know, that we're following the rules of the game and that's all we have to do. Now we can do whatever we want to do to maximize profit. No, there's also an idea of the spirit of the rules and the spirit of the laws. And there are many, many ideas like this. I mean, the idea of covenant or brit in Hebrew, that it's a shared agreement among equal partners. And if you start from there, I think that a lot of the ways that we think about business today could be transformed. The focus on God, in my thinking at this point, is much less important to me for the purposes of teaching business ethics, because I don't want to get bogged down in theological discussions about the nature of God and God's relationship to men and women. I want to focus in on the business enterprise, and I want to find language in the tradition that we can use to improve business life.
When one is involved in an interfaith center, it's very important to think through the religious principles that will guide the work that we're trying to accomplish together. We start from this very profound and very simple notion that when you explore all of the world's great religions, that there are basically three principles that we all agree on. The first principle is this idea of loving the Creator. We all agree that our actions honor our Creator, and that's an important tenet. Secondly, there's the notion of loving each other, how we interact each other, how we honor what is holy and spiritual in each other. And then finally, this notion of loving creation, that we at ICCR believe very strongly that we are stewards of the blessings that God gave us, and that as stewards, we have a real responsibility to demonstrate that stewardship in all of the choices, investments, and decisions that we make. And there are times when there are conflicts, where there are breakdowns around issues, where there are things that need to be negotiated and navigated. And I will say that when one is in the business of corporate social responsibility and one is viewing investments through this lens of justice and sustainability, if you start from those three principles, you make some pretty good judgments about what you take on.
I think one of the things that has come up for me in terms of my own spiritual practice is, well, my own research. I interviewed 36 Buddhist teachers as part of my doctoral research, and asked them very intimate questions about the exact nature of what they experienced in terms of insight and how it changed them. And one of the things that came up was clearly that most of the teachers had experienced some shift in their sense of self. But what was really interesting was how that impacted on how they acted in the world. And the deep sense that I got from talking to really leading Buddhist teachers from around the world was this deep sense of appreciation of life. And I think it's that sense of connection and the joy, and it's really the ability to really have and sense sympathetic joy, which is joy in other people's accomplishments or successes, which I think in this very competitive society is a rare thing. So I see there's tremendous benefits from that. But what I also noticed was that these teachers didn't stop their practice because they had suddenly been enlightened. So they've continued to practice their meditation, which is really a concentrated technique which helps you still your mind and deal with thoughts that come up. And my experience from meditation is that it allows you to deal with impulses. So if you think about how meditation might impact on, or spiritual practices might impact on corporate life, then meditation's a very powerful thing because you don't get hooked into flaring up and having arguments about trivial things. Your ego doesn't get hooked into making decisions so easily, and you're not so impulsive as you might otherwise be. But rituals and the other aspects of practices are really important too. Right speech, for example, in Buddhism is a very important practice, because I've noticed that if you practice thinking about how you talk about others, and for me that's how I speak to others in terms of, is this a respectful way? And I think that becomes a very powerful practice and has an impact on the people you work with. So there are ways in which these little micro acts, in fact, add up over time to something that's positive.
Dr. David Bubnalytic is a student of Buddhism and teaches sustainable management at the University of Technology in Sydney. In this program, we'll look closely at some businesses and their leaders, who could be described as perverse, and others that are providing an ethical business model. Organisational consultant Dr. Susan Long has identified the character traits of perverse corporations in terms of the deadly sins.
I think in terms of the deadly sins because, first of all, I started to see, think about this whole notion of what's happening in organisations when they make mistakes and they take the second step of not just making the mistakes and telling their shareholders or whatever, but when they start to cover up. I wondered, why would one go that far? And the first organisation that I, corporate in the public sphere that I started to look at, was Long Term Capital Management, a hedge fund in the US. And I was particularly interested in this because they developed what they called these money machines that they thought were fail-safe in investment strategy and in the bond markets. And they had a couple of Nobel Prize-winning academics working with them on this. It looked like they were going to do enormously well. And when you looked into the case, because eventually they crashed and had a huge influence on the whole world financial system, when you actually started to look into this, you found that there was immense pride in what they had done. They felt so proud of their having these Nobel Prize winners with them. They felt so proud of having discovered what they thought was a fail-safe way of making money. And their pride made them blind to the not correct assumptions that were in their money-making machines or their way of working. And there were warning signs, and people were telling them about the warning signs, but in their pride, they pushed that aside. So I then thought, well, if it's pride that did this to this company, maybe I could look into what are some of the other emotional characteristics that go alongside pride. Often, you know, pride and arrogance, but greed, envy, sloth, and anger and avarice and all of these sorts of things. So I tried to look for companies where I saw some of this operating amongst the senior management. And sometimes when it becomes strong amongst the senior management, it washes down through the whole culture of the organisation.
The notion of, you know, this one person or the narcissistic eye that is a centre of knowledge and understanding and of inspiration for an organisation, I think is an illusion. Organisations are complex networks. And that in some ways, a CEO is much more like a steward than a leader in this kind of simple sense of a leader. And I think most leadership theories are very simplistic. And I think once we understand that, you know, we don't pay the President of the United States an equivalent salary, even though he's running a multi-trillion dollar enterprise, because we understand he doesn't run a multi-trillion dollar enterprise. But we don't understand that the leaders of large corporations also don't run those corporations. It's a huge collective effort. I think that relates to the sorts of thinking that spirituality is bringing. And it's this sense of humility and the sense of being honest and open about what we actually can do and what we can't do, and the sense of not taking what isn't ours. And I think in situations where people have been, the recent case with Qantas, where the CEO, I think, was there for 6 or 9 months and left with a salary package of $16 million, even though the share price went down and the performance of the organisation went down, I think that's just wrong.
And the dictionary says about perverse that it's wayward, it's evil, it's persistent in error, if you look into dictionary definitions. And you find organisations that become like this, and yet alongside that, there's a whole crew of people within the organisation that are working quite morally, ethically, so that these dynamics sit side by side. I think one gets the sort of notion when I say perversion in organisations that somehow it's a huge evil kind of conspiracy, but that's not the case. I find that these, what I've called the sins of the perverse organisation, sit alongside some more virtuous aspects.
Dr. Susan Long is a management consultant and president of the Psychoanalytic Studies Association of Australasia. In the global economy, workers at home and abroad have to be considered when operating a socially and environmentally responsible business. Converge International is a not-for-profit counselling organisation, established 50 years ago by people from 13 Christian denominations. Their work involves providing support and counselling to 3 million employees in 700 companies across Australia, New Zealand and Asia. This service is increasingly important as the nature of our work changes. Lindsay McMillan is the CEO of Converge International.
The nature of work today is very different to the way it was a decade ago, or certainly 2 decades ago. And this is largely brought about by technology and globalisation and communications. Let's go back and explore some of those. Let's just look at the technology. There is no doubt that companies these days who provide an employee with a laptop, with a PDA, with a mobile phone, there is an unwritten rule that says that I own you and you are available 24/7, 360 degrees. It appears to be acceptable that if I phone you or email you on a Saturday afternoon or a Sunday night, the nature of work these days is that you should reply to my email or my mobile. Now, what that means is that the work then becomes predominant over and above other relationships. There is also a nature around the way work is conducted these days. For instance, we don't have a beginning and end to work. Basically, these days, we offer the fact that here are your KPIs and here is the time frame in which they have to be met. It is now up to you to deliver that. the organisation or the company will also provide every opportunity for you to complete those KPIs in a way that appears to be easy for you, but actually challenges the use of my time if I'm the individual. For instance, major corporations have offices open 24/7. Others design buildings that actually have restaurants that start for breakfast, lunch and dinners. Now, all of this comes back to one of the major heartbeat concerns of the Australian employee, which says there is a disconnection or a breakdown in community or my relationships because I don't feel connected. And work actually doesn't encourage that as well. And I think that's a critical element of the way in which business is impacting greatly on relationships and purpose and meaning.
I think that the fact that we're expected to be available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at our jobs is becoming very, very difficult for people to balance their private lives with their careers. And I think, again, here, religion can play a very positive role in the idea of the Sabbath, taking off one day a week. You're stepping out of time for a moment, and you spend it with your friends, you spend it with your family, and you don't go on the computer, and you don't read your emails, and if the telephone rings, if you're an observant Jew, you don't answer the telephone. And Rabbi David Hartman of Israel talks about the Sabbath consciousness, and I think that that's an idea that certainly Judaism and religion in general can teach other perspectives. How do we do this? You know, our students do this all the time, though. Our students are almost all Orthodox Jews. So, you know, when they take a job, they tell the employer that, look, I'm going to have to leave early on Friday afternoons, especially in the wintertime when the sun goes down earlier. And, you know, I think that there's a growing understanding and maybe even a kind of jealousy because, hey, you know, I want to be able to do that too. And the thing is, anyone can do it, but you need a community to be able to do this. You cannot do this on your own. And I assume from other religious perspectives, the same kind of thing, that if you don't have like-minded people, it's going to be very difficult to do this.
You're listening to Encounter, abc.net.au/rn. This week, we're delving into the corporate world and finding out what efforts are being made to inject ethical behaviours into business culture. The Interfaith Centre on Corporate Social Responsibility, based in New York, is a good example of an organisation that was set up because it saw unethical business behaviour. Laura Berry is the executive director.
In 1971, one of the deepest issues that the group of individuals that were to become the Interfaith Center on Corporate Responsibility were troubled by was the role that American companies played in investing in apartheid South Africa. We began to take on our role as investors by talking to high-level corporate managers in these companies to talk about changing the way they approached their investments in South Africa and to begin to think about divestment, to begin to think about some other approaches that would ultimately add pressure to the fall of this egregious regime. So we started with South Africa. At the present time, ICCR members are working on a huge spectrum of issues. Some of the most current and most topical issues are access to safe and clean water, access to food, access to medicines, both domestically in the United States, where, as you may know, healthcare is a lively debate right now, as well as global access to medicines for pandemic diseases in poorer countries. We work on many issues related to climate change. We are also deeply engaged in the capital markets and have been, frankly, cited as being quite, if you will, prophetic in providing an early warning system that raised the question of subprime mortgages in the domestic markets back as early as 1993.
And also you're working in human rights, like sweatshops. Now, the manufacturing processes behind what we buy in the West are mostly invisible. So are you tracking goods that appear in, say, department stores, down the supply chain to the men, women and children often living in developing countries that are growing the materials or making the product?
We have been deeply involved in supply chain issues for many, many decades, particularly as manufacturing has become more global. And one of the benchmark pieces of work that we've been involved in quite recently has been with the huge global retailing company Walmart. We identified some issues in the supply chain of clothing. We discovered that Uzbeki cotton was very often being cultivated by young children in Uzbekistan, and we have worked with government agencies here in the U.S., with global agencies, with the UN, and with Walmart to first discourage this practice, but most importantly, to suggest to retailers that they have a responsibility for monitoring the supply chain for the clothing that they sell. So Walmart was the first company, and of course when Walmart makes a decision, it has a huge impact on global markets, to go very public and say that they would monitor sourcing in all of the cotton products that they use to ensure that no Uzbeki cotton was used in the clothing products that they sold in their retail facilities because of these concerns about child labor.
Now, this is a very complex issue, isn't it? I mean, how does that then affect the people in developing countries? If Walmart isn't buying their cotton, not buying their products, then does that affect their livelihood?
Our hope is not that people will withdraw, in the case of Uzbeki cotton, from Uzbekistan or withdraw from those markets. Our hope is that forced labor by children as a practice will end.
Today, businesses that take advantage of global financial opportunities are common. But does this relationship with other countries also translate into a sense of responsibility for our distant neighbours? Moses Parver again.
One of the things that I've been thinking a lot about lately is the fact that there are actually twice in the Bible the commandment to love the stranger. One time we have in the Bible, love the neighbour. And I think that one of the emerging issues in ethics is, how do we broaden the circle of ethics? How do we continually broaden the circle of ethics? It's a lot easier to, you know, treat your neighbors well. You see them every day and you're interacting with them on a face-to-face basis. But how do we learn how to love the stranger? And traditionally, from a Jewish point of view, the idea of loving the stranger has been interpreted in a very, very narrow way. It's generally been interpreted as love the convert to Judaism. And there's meaning in that. However, I think that today the responsibility is to begin to reinterpret this. You know, here in the United States, we had a kosher meat producer. They were brought up on charges. The trial is actually ongoing right now. And they had hired workers from across the world, and they were illegal aliens in the United States. And, you know, the question was, how are they treating these workers? And clearly, this is a violation at a very simple level, I think, of the biblical commandment to love the stranger.
What a lot of companies are doing with corporate social responsibility now is a recognition of interconnectedness. They're recognising that their stakeholders are party to their own success. And so companies like Westpac, who engage with the community, find that the community respects them and they gain in reputation. And that there's a certain loyalty that comes with that. By engaging with stakeholders, companies also get to find out a lot about themselves, how other people think about themselves, what they're doing that may be seen by others as bad, and therefore they can start to look at how do they ameliorate risk. the risk of, for example, that Shell Corporation experienced when they, as a routine operation, decided to scuttle the Brent Spar rig in the North Sea that where they stored oil and it reached its natural life and they were planning to scuttle it. Greenpeace got wind of this and set up a campaign that said you shouldn't be dumping things in the ocean. If you talk about sustainability, then you shouldn't be doing this and you should be recycling it and you should be doing the right thing. Now, Greenpeace developed enough societal support that, in fact, Shell's sales went down. And so it cost them more money than it was worth, as well as damaged their reputation. So I think companies have learned those sort of risks are important to be aware of and to keep in contact with key stakeholders who might, like Greenpeace, decide that you're target of the month for some of your corporate behaviour.
There is, in fact, some new commentary that's emerging that says that because people are working so long at work and that people will be working longer in terms of years at work, that work will become the new determinant of community and community changes and community's values. And I think if that's going to occur, previously the churches were the hallmarks of the moral compass. And I think if these conversations continue, it has the potential that business will need to actually look at the new determinants of what is a healthy workplace that continues to build community and moral value and respect for the individual and family and relationships.
Lindsay McMillan, CEO of Converge International. So finally, how can business leaders or people who own a few shares and are concerned about the way businesses operate create positive change in the corporate sector? Laura Berry is the Executive Director of the Interfaith Centre on Corporate Responsibility, or ICCR.
For most investors, the very first tier of ethical behavior and a willingness to push corporations toward change is to take your proxy ballot and vote it. Take responsibility for the governance structure of the company that you hold. And I would often say the just vote with the nuns philosophy was that, you know, if you don't want to wade through the proxy statement, very often women religious have been very involved in filing resolutions around human rights and sustainability issues. If you see an order of Roman Catholic nuns putting a resolution forward, the easiest thing to do is say, you know, if they've done this homework, I'm voting with them, because very often management will recommend a vote against some of the advisory social resolutions.
But it's not always that simple. I mean, there may be issues that the nuns support that I may not. So it probably isn't advisable to blindly accept what others are doing, is it, even if they're religious?
Oh, I think that the notion of blindly accepting anyone's advice without thinking very deeply about how one defines morality is a very important issue. For example, one area right now that is controversial in interfaith communities is the issue of divestment from Palestine and what's going on in Gaza, what's going on in the Middle East. How does one approach what holdings you have in the context of destroying settlements, et cetera, et cetera? It is greatly controversial in our community, and one of the principles that ICCR has maintained throughout our nearly four decades is that there are so many issues that we can work on together and speak with a unified voice. That in these areas where there is not universal agreement and where our particular doctrines do not lead us to a common point of view, members are, of course, welcome to use any of the tools that we've developed to move their own issues forward, but they're not brought into the body of ICCR's work. So it's important for all investors to really center their own hearts on these issues and to make decisions about how they act this out in their own portfolios and in their own judgments.
Because one doesn't have to be religious to see injustice and greed perpetrated by the corporate sector and want to do something about it. So do we really need business leaders with a religious or spiritual background to make a difference?
I think that we already have many religious leaders and many spiritual business leaders. And I think, you know, for those business leaders, they have to begin to understand their tradition in a much more expansive kind of way than they have traditionally because of these changes in transforming the economy towards a global economy. I do believe that secular business leaders can also return to their traditions, whether they're Kantians or whether they're utilitarians, and come to many of the same conclusions that I'm coming from a religious perspective. Again, I think that the goal here is to create a common business ethics, and we have to talk across traditions, whether they're religious traditions or secular traditions. I'm going to use my religious sources, my Jewish sources, the Torah, the Talmud, later rabbinic sources, and I would expect Christian leaders to use their sources, and I expect secular leaders to use secular philosophers.
Well, I think the ethics of business ultimately comes down to individual ethics, and people will be presented at some point in their career with an ethical dilemma. One of the things that links ethics to spiritual insight is that spiritual insight has really two dimensions. One is it doesn't necessarily come about unless you have certain aspects of your life have to be settled. It's important to start sorting out your life, and a life in which there's deception, where there's harming, where there's a whole range of kind of what we would call negative actions is destabilizing in a life. If you deceive people, then eventually you have to keep tabs on your deceptions, and that becomes a complicating factor. The other side, I think, of ethics, certainly in Buddhist ethics, comes from actually having an insight into who you are. And if you suddenly drop that sense of an individual eye and start seeing yourself as being part of a much bigger picture, as not necessarily being the center of the universe, but being a center in the universe, then I think your way of thinking about the world is very different. There's a sense of appreciation, deep appreciation and love that emerges.
That brings us to the end of this encounter. My thanks to David Bubnalytic, Moses Parva, Laura Berry, Susan Long and Lindsay McMillan. For more information, go to our website, abc.net.au/rn/encounter, where you can also find a transcript of this program. Technical production today was by Phil McKellar. I'm Kerry Stewart, and it's been good to have your company.
Hi there, Geraldine Doog here. We've just had the pleasure of hearing five creative thinkers tell us what they think should be the priorities for this new century. If you missed it first time around, you can still hear them all. People like Susie Orbach.
Now we no longer see the body as biological. We see it as something that we have to shape, a dress or a kitchen or something that could be in our own image.
Susie Orbach and all of our creative thinkers are still available and can be downloaded from the Radio National website.